Now we're about to hear a segment from the Steiner Show archives. Please let us know your thoughts by tweeting us at Mark Steiner, emailing us at talk@steinershow.org, or posting on our Facebook page. And James McBride, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. This it's an amazing book. It's about our state, obviously, the Eastern Shore, which was really also just pretty amazing. But I want to talk about how you came to this book. I mean, just for our listeners who have not yet read the book, I mean, it takes place during slavery on the Eastern Shore, about a woman who's deeply mystical, who it is the struggle over going to freedom and how you get to freedom, the complexities of white and black in all of that. So I'm curious, talk about your sojourn to this book.
Well, I was, I'd wanted to write about the Civil War and slavery, but I couldn't figure out a good way to do it without, I just got stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a drive down to, down on State Route 50 near Cambridge, and I saw a sign that said the birthplace of Harriet Tubman was nearby.
Oh, yes, right, right.
So I just, I drove my little, you know, I have a little old 1991 Volvo.
Do you?
I still drive it.
That's good, man. That's good. That's good.
And I drove around to this, I followed the signs, and I came to a cornfield. And there was a little sign there, and I just stood around for a while, and I just started to wonder about her, basically, and how they managed, how she managed to move some 300 odd people up through the Eastern Shore during slavery time. But I was also intrigued about, I mean, the Eastern Shore is a very interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you drive into the Eastern Shore, into the backwood areas of it, or the back areas of it, it's pretty much now as it was, you know, 100, 200 years ago.
In more ways than one.
Well, I don't know if it's. Fortunately, I didn't have any experiences like that when I was down there. I had a pretty good, you know, pretty good time. I think that I think people make choices about how they want to live based on criteria that sometimes I might not agree with. So mm-hmm. I'm pretty open-minded when I deal with people, and so I didn't have to. I had a little bit of trouble with the Eastern County Historical Society. They were a little bit.
Yes, Eastern Maryland. Yep.
Yeah, they were not that useful. I went in there to get to try to find the map, and the lady just basically told me to go to the library and basically told me to get out. But other than that, I didn't have much trouble down there.
Mm-hmm. So here we are on the Eastern Shore, and what was your discovery process about Harriet Tubman once you were standing in that field?
Well, I was amazed at how smart she must have been,
mm-hmm.
because you know the Eastern Shore has no mountains. There are no real hills.
Right.
You know, there's just it's all flat. It's all swampland. It's all you have to kind of know the water to move around. And I began to imagine what it must have been like for her. I started reading some books. I started talking to some of the local, you know, quote-unquote local people, and it became clear to me after a while that there was during slavery time, there must have been some kind of mass, silent movement to get these people moving from the Eastern Shore to Delaware and Philadelphia, which was basically the Freedom Line. And how they did it clearly was some sophisticated business and using the water and watermen. And, you know, so I started to investigate watermen and how watermen lived and who they were and so forth. And they were fascinating. They were and are, you know, a fascinating group of Americans, both black and white watermen, the people who worked on this, you know, who tongued for oysters off the Eastern Shore in the Chesapeake.
Well, you said something about the watermen there that I never thought of that I'm very intrigued by, the way you described the culture of the watermen in the 19th century as a group of people who really, if they weren't anti-slavery, they clearly weren't pro-slavery. The culture being different than the plantation owner's culture, which is a revelation to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a fellow by the name of Thomas Flowers who was a city councilman or a council. He was from Hooper Island, I believe they call it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and he wrote a couple of unpublished books about watermen's life. There's also a guy named Fred Tilp who wrote a couple of books that were published by Tidewater Press, I believe it's called, about the life of Waterman. There's several books about, there's lots of books about Waterman that you can find down on the Eastern Shore. You can't find them anywhere else. But they were a group up in, you know, pretty much unto themselves because they lived off the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like cowboys, except they were tougher. You know, if you look at the Wild West, you know, the mythical creatures of cowboys, who are kind of the mythological American heroes there, these tough guys who drink hard and, you know, they were out on the prairie and they fought off Indians and, you know, the women were all clean and they all looked good and so forth. You know, the Watermen weren't like that. You know, they were tough men and women who fished in the winter and farmed during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very independent. All the way until the Annapolis Bridge was built, the Watermen kind of stood alone. They didn't like outsiders. You know, they were people from Hooper's Island, for example. When they went to Cambridge, you know, they would kick tail between Cambridge and Hooper's Island just because they were, you know, they had that territorial sense of this is who we are.
And that's what you did, and you weren't afraid to fight.
Well, no, I mean, you wouldn't find me tangling with any of them. But then they were deeply religious, and they were, you know, they really were profoundly religious, and they were deeply affected by a fellow by the name of, I believe his name was Reverend Adam Wallace. He was a minister who traveled around the Eastern Shore by boat preaching, because some of them didn't have churches. If they had churches, the minister would visit, and he visited this parish and that parish, and he began to preach about the evils of slavery during the 1820s and 30s, and that had a profound effect on the Watermen. Watermen were very religious because they, you know, God was a big deal to them, for the obvious reason that they, you know, they understood the power and majesty of God because they were on the bay all the time, and they understood how quickly a life could get washed away if you were out in the water and a storm came up quickly and so forth. So this one minister's preachings during that period started to kind of have a pretty profound effect on a lot of the Watermen. They were never crazy about the rich timber owners and plantation owners that lived on the Eastern Shore, partly because the plantation owners were basically rich people. When I say plantation owners, the plantation owners on the Eastern Shore were more dealt in timber, big oystering boats, and tobacco rather than cotton.
Right, not so much cotton. Right.
Yeah. So they weren't that fond of the rich folks either, and they weren't that fond of slavery, partly because slavery meant free labor, so that when they wanted to get a job, they were competing with slaves who didn't have to get paid, whose masters would get paid a smaller fee than they, meaning the Watermen, would be paid. So they weren't that fond of slaves or slave owners. They were pretty much an independent body.
So one of the things that runs through this book, and as an aside, the Watermen made me think about Appalachian culture in terms of their anti-slavery position, which I never thought about with the Watermen. But one of the things that you delve in so deeply that few have touched on in books about the period of slavery in American history is the complexity of race, even during the time of slavery. It wasn't simply just black and white. I support slavery. I'm against slavery. I'm a slave. You're not. There's the nuances of society were as deep then as they are now.
Well, you know, that's really the story,
right?
And then we're living that now with the current administration of Barack Obama and all of this, you know, the bickering and the kind of hooliganism that's going on with regard to the deliberation about health care. Part of the problem is that during slavery was that it was a complicated problem for the Eastern Shore because the Eastern Shore stood right near the Freedom Line. You know, once you hit Annapolis, you were only 80 miles away from Philadelphia, and it was known to blacks in the South that if you could get up to this part of that, meaning the Eastern Shore, up to this part of America, you had a shot at getting free.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one problem. The other problem was that Eastern Shore, many white people were ambivalent about slavery. Most white people didn't own slaves. And so, you know, what let slavery live was this whole business of racism and white superiority and so on and so forth. Now, that's easy to say, and that's easy to implement as a policy. But when, you know, when you own one or two slaves, which down on the Eastern Shore, most people own slaves, only own one or two or a family, and they become part of your family. They become part of your life. Selling one of them off is not as easy as it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, for example, Kathleen Sullivan is a good example.
Right.
You know, she owns these three slaves. She needs to sell them because she lost her husband on the Chesapeake. Her husband was a waterman. He died, and his slave died with him on their boat. So now she has three slaves left. She has to sell one of them, otherwise she's going to lose her farm. She can't bring herself to do it. She's starting to have doubts about slavery. These are the kinds of feelings that led up to the Civil War that were becoming more and more apparent that this whole business of owning human chattel was not really working out that well. And so people were not always happy about the business of slavery. And so people had various feelings about it. Yet the economic business of it had to move forward because slavery was economic business. So it was the great unspoken problem that never seemed to be able to be resolved easily.
It's rare that someone can describe or write about what you just spoke about, which is the intimate, intense relationship between some owners and slaves. Slavery was horrendous, and it was the most horrific, horrible thing that happened to people, I think, in our history. But that, again, it's that complexity of those relationships, especially on the Kathleen Sullivan level. Or even with Denwood, the slave catcher, who had his own doubts about what he did for a living.
Well, I mean, that's Denwood. It was he was a great character.
He was a great character.
Book, partly because he was a waterman, and partly because he worked as a slave catcher, and he was the best slave catcher that had been on the Eastern Shore for years, and then he retired, and then he comes back to take this one last job. The complexity of the relationships between black and white really is why I wanted to write about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the stereotypical view of it was that it was, you know, the master has a whip, and he's whipping the poor slave, and the slave is saying, oh, please. You know, that's not really, yeah, that happened, but a lot of other stuff happened, too.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reason why this business lasted for 400 years other than just out-and-out racism. There was a certain comfort level that, you know, if you owned a slave, you had to feed that person. You had to feed, clothe, and house that person. You had to fill him, not only him or her, not only with the sense of that you were superior, but you also had to give them a sense of safety and a sense of comfort and so on and so forth. And some people like that. Now, that's not to say that I would have liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking for people who are no longer here. But listen, if you work at the post office long enough, you feel like you're a kind of slave. Not that the post office is bad for those who work at the post office.
Right. I mean, it helped build the middle class in America. Right.
I don't want to set off any post office, you know. Like,
yeah.
But, things are the way they are. And what happens is humans adapt and develop relationships that simply cross the legal boundaries that we set up. So, you know, you had slaves who fell in love with their masters, and you had masters who fell in love with their slaves. And you can't really legalize how people feel.
Right.
And ultimately, the humanity of your subject, the humanity of human beings' feelings for each other will eventually either come forth or they won't. But even during slavery time, as complicated as relations are between blacks and whites now, they were as complicated then as they are now. The only difference was that whites had the absolute last word most of the time. But slaves were very clever about manipulating their masters and manipulating society into moving things in their direction. That's not to say that I'm not saying slavery was good. I'm just saying
no, you're not.
People like pets understand how to manipulate the master at certain points.
Well, as you're describing it, it made me think of that whole idea of people who owned slaves were like may have fallen in love with people who they held as they fell in love with their dog or fell in love with some other.
Yeah, well, that's not something that black people like to hear.
No, no, but I'm just saying that's I'm saying that's part of the reality, I think, as well.
Yeah, listen, that's true. The true reality of all of us is that slavery made slaves of us all.
Yes.
It made slaves of the slave master and the slave himself. Frederick Douglass wrote that with, he just wrote about that with just profound clarity.
He did.
And that's why Denwood is such an interesting character. Because he's a person who, slaves know him, and they know that if they're running away, and he's chasing somebody else, if they're running away and they run into him, he's not going to bother them. He just wants the one person that he's being paid to catch. So there's a certain amount of trust between Denwood, the slave catcher, and the slaves he's chasing. There's a certain amount of respect. They might not like each other, but Denwood knows that slaves who can abscond, who can get free and get 10 or 15 or 20 miles away from the master, are pretty smart. Because slaves who ran away and escaped had to be, most slaves were caught. The ones who got away were really smart and usually physically and mentally extraordinarily tough. And that's why you needed a man who was physically and mentally extraordinarily tough to catch these people. But if he was not getting paid to catch you, and you ran up against him, he wouldn't bother you. So he had the respect of blacks who knew him, and most blacks did know him. Blacks knew who the slave catchers were. They knew, you know, they knew who the people whose, if your life was involved, if your freedom was involved, you know who's the guy whose job it is to catch you. You know him well, and you talk about him amongst each other and so forth. So that's what makes him an interesting character in the book.
I think I didn't know where I was going to go with Denwood, but I'm obviously at the end of the book. We won't talk about that, but I was just very taken with his character, with all these characters, really. I mean, for most of them you could find an empathetic core to. But before I come to that, because I want to talk about Patty Cannon and Liz Sprockett, which are two seminal figures who I think were both based on real human beings. But I want to go somewhere else first. Another subtext in this book, is the slave underground, the move to freedom underground, the code that many historians say didn't exist and some say did exist, and clearly for you it existed, and it was a powerful piece of the story. So talk about that.
Well, first of all, well, the historians that say that when I was talking about the codes, the Underground Railroad, which was called the Gospel Train by many black slaves, historians say that there were no set of signals that blacks used, and the Underground Railroad code didn't really exist.
Right.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that
a code exists. First of all, as a musician, I can tell you, when I went to Oberlin Conservatory and learned African-American music, some of the first things that the professor started talking about was how these songs were used during slavery, so that when slaves were running, if someone was singing a certain song, these songs had meaning. And this
really?
Meaning, and this is clear as day. I mean, wade in the water meant to, you wade in the water, the dogs couldn't sniff in the water. We will break bread together on our knees. Get away, Jordan. All of these songs were used by slaves to either discuss their condition or to warn those who were hiding in the woods nearby whether it was time to go, lay low, move, and so forth. And Harriet Tubman, in two or three biographies written about Harriet Tubman, they talk pretty clearly about how she used songs as signals to tell people that she was leading the freedom, that it was time to go, or it was time to wait, and so forth. In terms of some of the other business, the quilts,
mm-hmm.
the hand signs, I believe that a lot of this stuff was used. Now, it might not have been used in South. I mean, you might have seen different signs in, Dorchester County that you didn't see in Columbia, South Carolina. But I'm convinced that there was a lot of signaling and code work that went on in plain sight. So I use that in the book because whites were very cognizant, especially on the Eastern Shore, they were very cognizant, especially as you got close to the Civil War, that slaves were trying to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would watch their slaves. I mean, if you pay $1,200 for a guy, which was, you know, I don't know what that would be in today's dollars, but it would be, I don't know,
five figures at least, right?
You know, you'd watch that guy, and if he was young and he had a chance to spawn and make more slaves for you, you're watching him, and if he takes off, you might be hung up bad. So you're watching him close, and so what blacks did was they just developed a set of codes that would allow them to speak to each other, to let know that this one is hiding or that one's moving or I got two here, I'm trying to move them. And if you spoke out against this, if you gave it away, if you were found out, you would, your life would be in jeopardy. So people didn't say anything about it. That was one of the big things that Frederick Douglass wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
When he criticized a guy named Box Brown. There was a fellow named Henry Box Brown who put himself in a box,
right,
and mailed himself to New York or something like that.
Philadelphia, I think.
Well,
it was Philly, yeah.
And Frederick Douglass was very critical because he said, you just closed another gateway to freedom. And Frederick Douglass was very specific that there were codes that were used, and he never told how he got free. He never wrote about it, and it died with him.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that particular aspect, that he never wrote about how he got free. You're right. He never did.
Yeah, because, you know, he didn't want to close the gate for the next person. I'm convinced, and historians have indicated, that a lot of these people who came through the Eastern Shore came through with the help of black and white watermen, some of whom were ministers, some who were just against slavery, some of whom had other reasons to help slaves escape. And they would hand them off from one, you know, from one creek and canal to another. Because you can't, the Eastern Shore is just, it's like a, if you imagine a bunch of grapes, that's how the Eastern Shore is. If you imagine just water going between all of those different grapes, that's how the Eastern Shore is. It's
right.
Waterways everywhere.
Everywhere. Have you ever had, what you're talking about right now, and because of this book, Song Yet Sung, have you ever spoken to groups on the Eastern Shore, like the Watermen, the mixed groups on the Eastern Shore, about your book and this and where your ideas came from?
No. No, I will. You know, in October I will.
On the Eastern Shore?
I did meet a Waterman there who's a historian, the son of a Waterman, who was an amateur historian.
Who's that?
I can't recall this guy's name.
Okay.
But he was one of the people who created the walking tour of the Harriet Tubman.
Oh, yes, I know the guy. I know who you're talking about.
Underground Railroad. He's a fascinating guy. He's very smart. McLaughlin, or?
Yes.
Is that his name? John McLaughlin?
John McLaughlin, I think that's who it is. And the conversation we're having now is a conversation that I think, this is a little digression from your book, but not completely, is a conversation that could be very profound if people on the Eastern Shore, or anywhere else, but let's just say the Eastern Shore for a moment, watermen, farmers, black, white, heard this and wrestled with it together. Do you know, like they had a program here 15 years ago that I was part of where black and white congregations and Jewish and Christians got together and wrestled with Genesis for a year together, cross. This is, you could do that with this book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, all of my books move toward the commonality of the human spirit. That's where, more or less, where I live creatively. I happen to think that Eastern Shore folks have a very proud and very fascinating history because their web of relationships that existed between them is very close. And I think it would probably help people to understand that they have a shared history with regard to slavery. I mean, the town of Trapp, for example.
Yes, Trapp, T-R-A-P-P-E.
T-R-A-P-P-E.
Right.
I understand that during the Civil War, you had one regiment from Trapp that was shooting against the other regiment because one regiment from Trapp served with the North and the other regiment served with the South.
This is a divided state all the way around.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listen, if you fight together, you might as well live together.
Right.
So right. I think that's one of the lessons that I got from writing Song Yet Sung, that slavery is our shared legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get, as a black person, once you get past the brutality of slavery, you start to understand and really trust that the relationships that existed during slavery, even though they were founded on something that was very unhealthy, there was some good that came out of it because it forced people to deal with their own morality. And the morality of Americans, and in particular, in this case, people on the Eastern Shore, is pretty good stuff. I mean, we have pretty good stuff in that regard. We're pretty loaded when it comes to trying to do the right thing. Americans really mostly try to do the right thing.
I'm speaking with James McBride about his book, Song Yet Sung. We'll take a short break. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of that conversation. And on our way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's not a bank. It's a credit union. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meqbaltimore.org. www.necu.com or at SantaShow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And now we turn to our conversation with James McBride about his book, Song Yet Sung. Coming back, before we move into your characters a bit more, the idea of the code, I mean, if you posit in this book that there were slaves who did not run but stayed behind, free and not free, just to be able to free their brethren, and it could be as complex as you describe it, from hand signals to bells ringing to quilts to all the rest, that's a pretty profound movement.
Well, you have to remember, if I'm married, you know, to my wife, and my wife is a slave and I'm not, because you had slaves who were married to free people and so forth.
Right, right.
I'm not going to leave until my wife is free and my children. I mean, that was really the dilemma for slaves. You could run off. I mean, masters oftentimes gave slaves money to go to town, you know, bring me a cow and three chickens and get the wagon fixed. And here's, you know, $20. And that would be enough to get you a long way if you were going to run off. But you had to remember that you had your kids there and your wife, and so you would stay. So if I was a slave and my wife were a slave and I were free, I'd be more inclined to try to work out a deal with my master so that I could free her and buy her. And that would take years. And if my master was a good master, if he was a good person, if his word was good, then maybe when I saved up enough money to free her, he would hold to his word. If he was a bad master, he'd just say, well, I'll do that, and then suddenly he dies. And then your wife becomes the property of his son. And then you really have problems. And then you decide to break because you think the son might not hold to his father's word. There were a lot of things. When you have something that's based on this web of relationships, it's flimsy business at times. So there were a lot of reasons why slaves decided to stay. One of them being that maybe you couldn't make it. Or if you got caught, if you got caught harboring slaves, it was really bad business. You really got into a lot of trouble. And that was something that, regardless as to what color you were.
Mm-hmm.
You can understand why slaves would serve as abolitionists and work on the Underground Railroad. It's much harder to understand why a white person would do it, because white people had nothing to gain. And I think that a lot of these white folks, a lot of these people who walk around now saying that I was, it's sort of like the 60s, like everybody claims they were, marching during the Civil Rights Movement, blah, blah, blah. A lot of blacks weren't even involved in the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
And so the whites who were involved were extremely brave, and the blacks who were involved were just unconsciously brave.
Right.
So I think it's the same way when you talk about slavery. You had people who really, really wanted to be free but didn't want to leave their families, or, as in the case of the book, knew that if they left their master would lose everything. Now, in Song Yet Sung, Kathleen Sullivan is very close to her slaves, and so her main slave knows that if he leaves, she's going to lose everything, including his sister and his nephew. I intentionally created that family, that situation, because both her husband and the husband of her slave, Mary, died on the Chesapeake. They were both watermen.
Right.
One was the master, one was the slave. So these people are already joined at the hip, joined by the death of their respective husbands.
That relationship you built between Mary and Kathleen Sullivan and Wiley and the white kid, Jeff Boy, I mean, it was such a complex, twisted, tied, love-stuck relationship between all of them. It was amazing. I like the way that both those characters, especially the way Mary and Wiley and Kathleen were really developed characters in this book.
Well, in novels, everything has to be connected,
Right.
In real life, in a novel, in a cheap novel, if you want someone to get lost, you just kill them off. You say, the guy walks in, pow, and the character's dead and so forth.
Right.
That's a pulp novel.
Right, right.
But in a real novel, or so-called literary novel, you have to follow the characters. And these men the slaves who worked for Kathleen, they respected and loved her, and they loved her children because they raised her children. They helped her raise her children. So when her child gets kidnapped, the kidnapper of their child, the woman, when her child gets kidnapped by the woman, it ratchets the story up a whole nother level, because now the plans for escaping are changed. You can't leave now because the kid is gone, and one of them saw who did it, and he's frightened of the kidnapper.
Right.
And so listen, we all talk about, like, if I was living, I remember talking to some high school kids, and one of them said, man, if I was around when it was slavery, I would just, I would get my gun, and, no, you wouldn't. You wouldn't do any of that thing. You would march along until you made decisions based on who you really are deep inside. And that's really what it was.
I keep thinking about it. I'm glad you're coming to the Eastern Shore, because I was one of those civil rights workers who went to jail on the Eastern Shore a number of times in the 60s. And for this book, it just, to me, it would be such an important piece for us here on that Eastern Shore to wrestle with. And just the whole state. It's really, because people need to kind of wrestle with what the real story of slavery is. And speaking of the story of real slavery, two of the characters, talk about Patty Cannon and Liz Spockett. The two people who were, as I understand, both based on real women in that period.
Right. Well, Patty Cannon is based on the real
Patty, a real person, Cannon. Completely. Her character's real.
Yeah, she was real, right. And that was her real name. And she was a gunslinging slave stealer from the Reliance, Maryland area. I believe it was called Reliance back then.
Mm-hmm.
She lived right on the line between Reliance, Maryland, and Seaford, Delaware. From
yes, the, right, right, exactly.
And her house, her tavern, sat in three different counties. So that any time the authorities from one county would step into one part of it, she'd step into another room, and she'd legally be in another part of in another county, and they couldn't bother her. And her job basically was to steal slaves that were owned by other people, hold them in the basement or attic of her tavern until the boats from New Orleans came up, and then she would sell them cheap to New Orleans slave traders. And once if you were a slave and you were sold to the Deep South, your chances of escape were just about impossible.
You were done, right.
So, she was ruthless. I mean, she killed white people as well. She would kill anyone that got in the way of her business. And she had a gang that she ran with, including her son-in-law. And they were pretty ruthless folks. She makes an appearance in this book, and she is the person who's chasing Liz Spockett, who is based on the character of Harriet Tubman. And Harriet Tubman in real life, and Liz Spockett has these dreams of the future, and she dreams of what the future is, and she dreams of like seeing black men running away from school and sucking giant cigarettes that make their minds stupid and listening to music that preaches murder. She has these dreams. She doesn't know what they mean, but they kind of they make her into a figure that other black people want to meet. And so the beginning of the book, she's captured by by Patty Cannon and ends up escaping from Patty Cannon's attic before Patty Cannon can sell her. So the whole book is a chase between these two women, with Liz being chased by Patty and then later being chased by Denwood and Patty, because Denwood is hired by Liz's owner to track her down. And most interestingly, Denwood and Patty Cannon don't like each other either, because he's a waterman who's ambivalent about slavery and has just taken the job, and Patty Cannon makes her living as a slave stealer. So you have all these competing interests who are running after this slave who was very, very good, very clever at eluding them, but is running out of places to hide.
Now, this character, Liz Spockett, the slave who is injured and then is being chased by both Patty Cannon and Denwood, and there's a big piece of this book is the chase, and you don't know what happens. It's a great mystery and gripping mystery in that sense, because you don't know where it's going to end up. And we're not telling folks where it's going to end up. You got to read the book to find out. But
yeah,
yes, but Liz Spockett, I mean, there's something, this is where the mysticism comes in. There's something very mystical about her, as there was, people say, about Harriet Tubman. And there was something that that she kind of, the power of her otherworldliness and the power of her faith, and the whole way that faith fits into all this in God. Is talk about how you came to that and what that all means for you.
Well, you know, I grew up in the church, and I believe in God, and I believe that God is a very forgiving person who forgives us of our past sins and will forgive the worst sin that you can possibly commit. And so, you know, the people who were involved in slavery, both slave owners and slaves themselves, were always looking for some kind of, looking for God to help them abscond from their deep, dark sins. And so Liz is a person who, when you read about Harriet Tubman, when you see the pictures of her, you know, she looks like my grandma. You know, she's old and she's sitting there. You know, she doesn't really look like the powerful, young, very vibrant, obviously physically fit and clever woman that she obviously was.
Mm-hmm.
And in real life, Harriet Tubman was struck in the head by not by someone who owned her, but by a white man that she was somehow got involved in a confrontation with when she was 12 years old or so. And because of that, because she got struck in the head, she would black out and fall asleep, you know, at the oddest places. And she often said that when she fell asleep, she would dream. And those dreams would tell her which way to move. The Lord would speak to her in those dreams. And so I imbued that character, that characteristic in the character Liz. And Liz's faith in God is something that she questions constantly when she's running, because she's so traumatized by her experience. And similarly, Denwood's faith in God is something that he constantly questions. He's lost faith in God because he lost his son. And so his faith in God is something that he constantly, it's constantly brought up to him, this whole business of God is real and God believes in you and so forth. And he, you know, he has to constantly remind people that he doesn't believe in God. But toward the end of his life, he starts to understand that God is real. And Liz has never lost faith in God, but she's lost faith in God's power to help his people. And that faith is revived as the book nears its end, partly because of the woolman character who meets up with
Woolman. Yes. I mean, Woolman, if you talk as much as you can about Woolman, in a sense, we also are not going to give anything away here either, but Woolman the kind of is the heart of the maroon life, is an amazing character.
Well, he's the character who really represents the kind of freedom that blacks really wanted, which is that he was a black who was gotten free as a child with his mother and basically lived in the woods, you know, away from everyone. And he's someone that everyone fears. You know, when kids would go to sleep at night, their parents would say, if you don't cooperate, you know, I'm going to get the woolman to come get you. Black folks were afraid of him as well as whites. You know, the rumor was that woolman lived in the forest with his children he had an alligator on a chain and he led him around and so forth. And so he was someone that no one had ever seen, but had heard of. And then Liz mistakenly comes upon the woolman's son who's caught in a trap and frees him. And somehow, by that act, she doesn't exactly earn the trust, but she earns the respect of the woman, who is a physical specimen and as a fighting unit, is no small thing. He was a character who, you know, who knew how to move through the woods, who never messed with anyone, but who was a formidable foe. And so once he's folded into this story, he sort of ratchets it up to the next level.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. James McBride, this is a phenomenal book. I just I appreciate you taking the time with us. James McBride wrote The Song Gets Sung, which is, of course, One Male and One Book is our book. He's also, of course, the author of the most famous book, The Color of Water, and Miracle at Santa Ana as well. And James McBride, thank you. It's just been so wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on the show, and I look forward to going to Maryland and eating some fish.
Got to have some fish. Got to have some crabs.
Yeah, I have plenty of crabs.
Plenty of crabs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was my 2009 interview with author James McBride. We have to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we have a brand new episode of Soundbites, our series on food, agriculture, and the environment. This week on Soundbites, we visit Black Dirt Farm in Preston, Maryland. Then we hear an interesting advancement in science that could pave the way for carbon-neutral fertilizer production. And we wrap up Soundbites with a recipe for mussels from Chef Stefano Porcile. We'll be right back.